This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's early in the course of the coronavirus pandemic, but a picture is becoming clear about the effects this will have on Utah businesses. The tallies have already started. Cancellations of conventions and events already have cost tens of millions, millions and millions more in empty hotel rooms and seats at restaurants, arenas, and performance halls. State leaders have created a task force to explore economic relief measures. Disaster loans, for example, are being made available, and local governments are considering their own options. But with so much uncertainty right now, it's hard to tell not only how long this pandemic will keep people indoors and isolated, but just what it's going to mean for dozens and dozens and dozens of restaurants and bars and shops, the mom-and-pop, hole-in-the-wall, run-from-a-shed businesses, the catering startups, the house cleaners, the ladies who do your nails, the bakers, the farmers. A lot of these guys live on a knife edge anyway. Their margins are so close anyway. And now this. So today in the program, we're talking about the effect of this coronavirus on us, on all of our neighbors, on the local economy, and the people who try and make it run every day. Joining us first on the program, Matthew LaPlante is with us. He's a Utah-based journalist, also an associate professor of journalism at Utah State University. And he's joining us in another room. We're safely isolated. Matthew LaPlante, welcome to you.
Thank you, Doug. I'm glad to be here.
Shireen Gorbani is with us, an at-large member of the Salt Lake County Council. She's joining us also in another room. And Shireen Gorbani, welcome to you.
It's nice to be with you at a distance.
Yes. All right. I guess I wanted to begin with one of those questions that is not really an actual question, but kind of a rhetorical question. Matthew, if you know what I mean, like what is going on? How are you thinking about, you know, the situation, like first impressions?
I feel like we are seeing something for I think for the first time in a long time, at least, and maybe for the first time ever, where there's this collective shared experience that's happening right now that transcends everything. It transcends everything, and we're all feeling it at the same time. And so what is going on right now is a complete shift of our paradigm. And I don't think that it's hyperbole to say. I really do believe it.
Shireen, what about you? What do you—
First and foremost, I think we're in a health crisis, and people need to be taking quite seriously the recommendations from health professionals, going to coronavirus.utah.gov to find information, calling the hotline if they're feeling respiratory symptoms, concerned about their health. But I agree. I think we're in a time where we're sharing a collective experience. It's been reminding me a lot, actually, of 9/11, except for that it's just ongoing, right? So day after day after day. So instead of just sort of one focusing shock, it's this ongoing, sustained uncertainty.
Matthew, you've talked about the fact that there might be some connection that you feel as well. At least the closest thing you can think of is that 9/11 experience. Similar in some ways, but different in some ways too, do you think?
I think similar in some ways for Americans in particular, but the big contrast for me to that experience, to the way that I experienced that time in our nation's history and the way I think many people experienced that time, is that the attacks of September 11th felt like something that happened to us as Americans very distinctly. It was something that happened to us as Americans very distinctly. Whereas what we're dealing with right now, in terms of just the overall way it is impacting our lives and our news cycles and our thoughts and everything that we think of when we wake up and what we're thinking about when we go to sleep, is not just happening to us on U.S. soil. It's happening to everyone everywhere.
Shireen, you know, I was thinking about the experience, of course, of the earthquake on Wednesday, which, like, if a pandemic virus wasn't enough, now comes this earthquake. And what happened when the shaking stopped and people, as I wrote in a newsletter this morning, ventured carefully out to sort of check with everybody. It seems like it revealed to me how social we are as as creatures, and how isolation is really difficult, but also how, you know, there's the bad stuff, and we can talk about that, but there's a lot of good stuff that seems to be revealed in these tough times, do you think?
I think that's so true. I saw it on my own street. I'm really lucky to live on a street that is a community, and people immediately, shortly, I guess I should say after, stepped out of their homes, shouted across the street, checked in on people. And we've been doing that actually this whole week. So I live in a community that has a number of older individuals, a number of women who live alone. And we've been, you know, sending texts, checking in, sending emails. There's also a really incredible resource that's out there. I'd love to mention that Salt Lake City's put out, which is a Hello Neighbor letter. And you can print it off. You can put your information and drop it on your neighbor's porch and just say, I want to make sure you have my cell phone. I want to make sure that you know you can reach out to me. It's a letter that can be used anywhere in this valley, across the state, really anywhere. But it's such a good resource for those connections that I'm lucky to have on my street, but I know a lot of people haven't met their neighbors. And it's a good practice to get into.
Is there anything distinctively local about this particular story? Like, what are you noticing about how this might be revealing something about us as a particular place? Like, is there a certain kind of, I don't know, value set or character that's coming to the surface right now? Matthew, what do you think?
Well, I think community support is, but it's an interesting kind of community support, right? Like, when my neighbors all came out, after the earthquake the other day, I walked down the street and I saw my neighbor Michelle, and she said, God, I just want to hug right now. We can't even hug each other. Yeah. And so, like, the way that we connect with our neighbors – now, we're not all hugging neighbors, right? So – but, I mean, you know, yeah, we are having this opportunity to connect with each other in a very local, very visceral way. And yet the way that humans are designed to connect, at least one of those ways, has been taken off the table.
Shereen, what do you think about that? Are you noticing anything particular about this place?
Yeah, I would say we live in a culture that has a penchant for planning.
Yeah, that's true.
We've got some really good infrastructure in place. We've got, you know, good rainy day funds. The thing I'm concerned about is that for a lot of Utahns, it's been raining. Even in this booming economy, even in what's, you know, been up to a few weeks ago, just economic growth that we haven't seen in other periods. We still have a lot of people who are living paycheck to paycheck who are really concerned about the economic destabilization that comes with this. So I'm concerned about those people who are, you know, a little closer to the edge than maybe some of our families that have been able to have that luxury of planning, the financial security. But having a strong economy and having elected leaders who plan is really important, and it's something that we do have here, and I'm grateful for that.
Matt, you've talked about how being prepared, something Shereen was mentioning, for, you know, for a disaster, is kind of baked into the DNA of this place.
I like that very much about this place. We are, like many Utahns, many people who now call themselves Utahns, my family is transplants. I grew up in California, and when I came to Utah and was introduced to the Latter-day Saint food pantry, I just thought it was the greatest thing in the world. I was just like immediately attracted to this idea that the predominant religion in the state encourages its members to plan for times like these. And what that allows for is for people to feel secure enough in their ability to provide for their own families at a time like this that they can devote a little bit of energy and a little bit of goodwill to others as well. And I just, God, I'm so glad that's part of our community. And it's something that my family, even though we are not Latter-day Saints, have embraced, although we don't have a pantry nearly the size of some of our LDS neighbors. But man, like, I feel very fortunate that we do have a community that thinks about planning.
In what ways do you both think the earthquake on Wednesday added another dimension to the story? I mean, besides just scaring people more, freaking people out more, it just seemed all the more surreal that in the middle of this pandemic, things started shaking in your house.
I teach a class in crisis communication at Utah State University, and it's a simulation-based class. And my students accuse me every semester of just going way over the top. And I've been getting email after email and tweet after tweet this week of people saying, oh my God, it's professor, it's like you are controlling the situations that are happening to us. And so I guess in one respect, I felt it was very appropriate, right? Like I fully expect crises to compound upon themselves and feel greater over time. And also, though, I know how debilitating that is for people because I see it in my students, even when we're just playing make-believe, how if I add a crisis on top of a crisis, it becomes debilitating to their ability to communicate in that crisis. And I think that that is the thing that I saw, although I think that we're already starting to recover from just a couple of days out, is sort of this indomitable spirit of people saying, okay, yeah, but that's not going to get us down either.
Shireen, one of the things you've talked about is the importance that at times like this, and the earthquake made me think about this too, local government, the importance of a local government seems to be revealed at times like this.
Yeah, I think this has been a real lesson for people to think about what is happening at their local level. What kinds of actions are their leaders taking? What kind of messages are they getting? Are they getting good information? Are they getting it regularly? All of these questions, I think, are really I'm excited as a person who's in the local elected office that more people are tuning in, paying attention, really looking for good sources of information and doing their best in many cases to try to share that information. I think the larger question that I keep struggling with and what really hit me after my home stopped shaking was thinking about we want to be prepared in a crisis, certainly, but we're really focused on it right now. In everyday times, in normal times, when we don't have a health crisis, when we don't have an earthquake, people need to be focused on and thinking about what are the appropriate resources to put into emergency management? What does it mean to have strong infrastructure, strong local government that can respond in a crisis like this? And we don't always want to have those difficult conversations when things are great. So I think it's I'm proud of the response of Salt Lake County. I think we're doing really good work, and I know that many people are working very long hours to keep this community safe. I struggle with the tension around the larger conversations happening where we hear a lot about small government, small government, small government, but then we want a big government response when there's a disaster. In order for that to happen, we have to be planning appropriately along the way. And there's a balance there. I'm really engaged in that question and in that debate. But I was worried. I thought immediately, what happens if this is? I didn't know where I was in terms of the epicenter of the shake, and I wasn't clear if we were going to see damage to our hospitals and what kind of disruption and maybe life safety issues would be facing. And to think about all of those responses and to think about the ways in which I believe our healthcare system is inadequately prepared to respond already, what all of those compounding factors might lead to.
I wonder also at moments like this, what does this reveal about people? Because, and I don't mean to be a buzzkill, Matt, about your reflections on, you know, the predominant culture and being prepared, but I wonder if there's also a con in that pro. For example, there was this weird rumor that was, I'm sure you heard about it, that started to flood social media from what was supposed to be a stake president. I don't even know where this was, but it talked about how there was a very large aftershock that was coming and everyone needed to get ready. Do you remember this? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I didn't see it, but it doesn't surprise me whatsoever. This is like in the midst of crisis, that is when rumors proliferate the fastest and in ways that are quite egregious. So
what does that say about us? I guess.
It says that we're living in a different world right now. We're living in a world in which we're still coming to terms with the power and the responsibility and also the consequences of a paradigm in which anybody can reach out to anybody else at any time and say something truthful or something that's not truthful. Shereen, go ahead.
I've been taking this very seriously. I do very regular updates on my Instagram, on Twitter. It's just at Shereen Gorbani if people are looking for information. But I really vet the information that I put there and I'm taking cues from the health department on the information that I'm putting out, going to sources that I know are doing the hard work of vetting the information before they are putting it out. And I do think this is both the upside and downside of a very interconnected community, that we can spread messages like wildfire if we want to, right? And so it's so important that you are looking for reputable sources and people who are coming to you with correct information.
And here's the challenge, though, right? This is the thing that we have to deal with right now, is that right now we want people to be leaning on their neighbors.
Yeah.
We want them to be trusting their neighbors and the people around them. And at the same time, we want them to only be sharing information from good, responsible, vetted sources. And so there's this shift, this balance that is really hard to find.
Do you think in some ways this will be a test of our character? Like, especially those of us who didn't grow up under the deprivation of a depression or the rationing and limits of a war. Is this in some – I don't mean to overdo this, but is this in some ways a test for our sort of social support network and the way we deal with things like this?
I think we're already being tested. And, you know, something like, I think the number is close to 30% of Utah children live in poverty. We have a lot of families for whom this is going to be deeply, deeply disruptive. And they were already living pretty close to the edge, right? So I think there's a lot that we can learn, and I think there's a lot that we can do better. But this is really an opportunity to think about where our social safety nets are failing.
I think that this is a test, and it is a opportunity to see who we are in a time in which we are having a shared experience. And that's a local test. It's also a global test. Mm-hmm. But it is very fascinating. Like, you know, I know social scientists love moments like this where something shifts so dramatically and everything is affected all at once, because it allows for a lot of really great examination and study as to causes and effects and correlations. And I think we're going to learn so much about who we are as a community and who we are as a human race.
I also hope we're learning who our neighbors are and really taking care of each other at that person-to-person level. I know a lot of people already do this.
That's Shereen Gorbani, an at-large member of the Salt Lake County Council. Matthew LaPlante also with us. He's a Utah-based journalist and associate professor of journalism at Utah State University. All right, you two, stay with me, if you will. We'll come back to you a little bit later in the program. We're going to take a break and continue the conversation in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
As a yoga teacher, Jesmyn Stanley is well aware that much of yoga culture in the U.S. can be a little tone deaf.
Trying to understand the difference between appreciation and appropriation helps me find my own footing.
This week on Preach, the author of Everybody Yoga, on how yoga became her spiritual practice and being brave enough to share your unfiltered self on Instagram. Find Preach wherever you get your podcasts or at preachpod.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about the impacts of the coronavirus on us, on the Utah community, local businesses and arts groups, our neighbors, our friends. So this is not just a conversation about health, of course, but the economic consequences and the emotional ones, too. I've been asking a number of you how you are coping, how you're dealing with all of this. Susanna Young sent us this. She said, I pulled into an In-N-Out drive-thru, ordered a meal. When I arrived at the pay window, the cashier said I didn't know anything because the car in front of me had paid for my meal. And I thought, well, I'll pass it along to the car behind me. Maybe that chain reaction is going on still. I hope so. Katie Barnes told us that the day-to-day of her household is not really all that different. She says, I work from home 100% of the time. We have no kids. But that said, there's some real economic anxiety we're feeling. I work in a non-essential client-based industry, and I definitely wonder if I'll still have money coming in a month from now as the public's disposable income shrinks and people stop buying anything other than sheer necessities. Joining us now on the program is Juliet Tennert. She's the Director of Economic and Public Policy Research, the Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute at the University of Utah. And Juliet Tennert, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Doug. It's a pleasure.
I wanted to begin. How difficult is it to say anything definitive about the economic, you know, impacts and prospects when this target just keeps moving right now?
Yeah, that's what's so difficult. I know, you know, economists, sometimes people think that we have these crystal balls, and we definitely don't. We're always looking in our rearview mirror, trying to interpret data. And so as this pandemic unfolds really quickly and things change day by day, it's really difficult to truly get a handle on the specific economic impacts. So we know that they're large.
I wanted to ask you about the timing of all of this, because it seems as though it could have been kind of a perfect storm of terrible timing, because I know there's a lot of talk about this economic expansion was already starting to slow down, and then this hits. What does that mean?
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, we are basically, we're 10 years into an economic expansion right now. That's like the longest economic expansion on record. And so we've been anticipating some deceleration in economic growth. And when I say deceleration, I don't mean an actual decline, but just economic growth starting to slow down. So nearing the end of a business cycle. And then we throw into it what we call essentially an economic shock. And that it just really heightens the risk, essentially, for more and more challenge.
All sectors of the economy are going to be affected, I'm sure, but there are those that will be hit worse than others. Which are the ones that stand out?
Yeah, so that, I mean, it's, you know, it's really, you don't have to be an economist to be able to identify this, but the most, you know, the sectors that are feeling like the most immediate impact are those that are like directly affected by some of these social distancing measures. Travel and tourism is essentially halted. Restaurant dining rooms are basically closed. And so we're seeing a tremendous, immediate, sharp impact in leisure and hospitality, transportation. And then layered on all of that, you know, this, with oil prices with where they are, we are also seeing the stress in natural resources mining. But really the main stress right now, direct impacts, measurable impacts, are in that leisure and hospitality industry.
What about geographic regions? Who gets hit the hardest, urban areas or rural areas?
Well, and that's so, you know, we actually, in our urban core, leisure and hospitality, affected by visitors, and then also just, you know, citizens, like we participate in leisure and hospitality sector within our urban core. And so there's certainly been an impact there. But when we look to our more rural places, many of their economies are deeply concentrated in travel and tourism, leisure and hospitality, taking advantage of all these incredible, you know, national parks, state parks. Those are in our rural areas. And then also our rural areas tend to be a little bit more concentrated in natural resources. And so, you know, we're seeing the effects and expecting to see the effects, both rural and urban. Rural areas, though, tend to be less economically diverse, and so those impacts can be even stronger there.
Do you think Utah's economy is going to be hit any differently than other places? I mean, how are we like other states, and how are we different? How's our economy different or distinct?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen this huge economic expansion nationally, again, 10 years in the making. Utah's certainly benefited there, and we've done better. So I kind of have been talking about how it will be challenging. It is challenging, but we're probably better positioned than many other places. So our employment base is 25% larger than it was at the last economic peak. Nationally, it's like 10% larger. 2.5% unemployment rate at last measure, incredibly low. And so I think that, you know, we're maybe better positioned. That would make us unique as we're dealing with some of these things. But, you know, like other places, we do have Travel and tourism is a major part of the economy. You know, there's at least 10% of all of our jobs are in that leisure and hospitality industry. And so this is not something that our state is immune to or can be immune to. I do, you know, note that our economy is actually, and it's kind of interesting, some people don't realize this, it's actually the most diverse economy in the nation.
Wow.
And so that will, yeah, so that will actually help us some, right? So as these impacts are taking hold in leisure and hospitality, transportation, mining, you know, we still have a great diversity in tech and life sciences and manufacturing and financial services that will help to pad some of that shock. You know, you look at a place like Nevada, that state or that economy doesn't have the diversity that the state of Utah has. So, you know, we're well positioned, but I just want to acknowledge it's still incredibly, incredibly challenging.
There's this kind of strange conflict going on from a public health perspective. We, of course, don't want people out in restaurants and stores, but from an economic perspective, we need them there.
Yeah.
So, like, what do policymakers do to kind of line up, you know, the public health with the economic incentive? What can you do?
Yeah, and that's where it's like it's so difficult. You know, I mean, we definitely have addressed economic contractions before through certain policy interventions, but those policy interventions aren't necessarily aligned with what we need to do in public health. And so policymakers are right now kind of looking to aligning both the public health, what needs to be done with public health, with what needs to be done to keep the economy going. And so I think that like part of that is just, yeah, recognizing that maybe those traditional incentives, you know, we don't want to do something that would push people into violating these social or physical distancing rules, but at the same time, make sure that people who are able to have the confidence to participate in the economy.
So talked to a friend of mine last night. He mentioned that he had a personal trainer that he wasn't able to see. And so what he did is he called her and he said, so I'm going to pay you like I would normally, like if I came in, and maybe you can just come up with a set of exercises that I can do. So he was adapting, right? He was trying to make that work. Now, a lot of us are sort of thinking about the similar kind of things. And so I guess my question is, does that work? Like if I buy a gift certificate to a restaurant or something else, can I make a real difference right now, even if that circumstance is more artificial than real?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Because I think so. This, you know, the public health issue, the coronavirus, it will touch many people through their health, but it will touch everyone through the economy. And so part of that is I think that some of us are, you know, there might be a natural inclination to pull back out of fear, and just being innovative about ways to participate in the economy is really important. Your friend is a great example. You know, rather than just we're not going to engage in this really, it's an important financial economic transaction, we're going to innovate and figure out a way to continue to engage in it. And so it does make a difference. Like those individual small circumstances can add up together to really help on the kind of confidence sentiment side.
How important is that? Like, how important is, and this is one of those sort of abstract things, but I know economists think about human nature all the time and behavior. How important is confidence to all of this?
It's incredibly confidence. And this is hard because, you know, it's really hard. I think as economists, we really like numbers, right? We'd like to get into an Excel file and look at actual GDP. But just as important as all of these super tangible economic activities is consumer sentiment. So John Maynard Keynes calls it animal spirit, where intuition and emotion actually play a large role in economic decision making. And so there are direct impacts, but there's the potential for great impact just through the sentiment side of things as people are fearful and hold back from engaging when they actually could be engaging.
You know, the president and some others have talked about that once the coronavirus spread slows, you know, the graph flattens, that the economy will rebound pretty quickly, he says. Is that true, do you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, again, I don't have a crystal ball, but kind of understanding what's at play here, that's a really reasonable expectation. Now, leisure and hospitality sectors, travel and tourism sectors, you know, if businesses can actually survive, which, I think with these policy interventions, there's good probability of many chances. So as businesses survive, there'll be a great pent-up demand to consume those things. And, you know, you could anticipate that pent-up demand on the other side of this coming into play and actually causing a push. And I, you know, thinking on the travel and tourism side, in Utah particularly, we've got some just amazing opportunities here with our state parks and our national parks. And even on our urban core, we've got some really neat cultural amenities, we call them, going on. And so I don't think it's unreasonable to think that if we can get through the public health crisis, that there will be this pent-up demand to actually, you know, spend in these areas. And Utah, again, can be well-positioned just because we're comparatively better than other places. Like, we have these really incredible places to visit that hopefully, as things return back to normal, we'll see an uptick in.
But I guess I wonder if for some businesses the damage has already been done. You know, they've missed rent payments, they've lost employees. And I guess the question is, how long can local businesses weather that storm before they've reached a point of no return and there's no rebounding anymore? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. And that's what we worry about, right? So that's what I say. If we can keep business afloat through this, then we can expect that surge or that pent-up demand. But to the extent that business has to actually shutter because, for example, a small mom-and-pop shop isn't able to make their rent and they're not able to come back online, that can have really major implications. Now, I think that with some of these policy interventions that we're hearing about, monetary policy, the Federal Reserve lowering that interest rate, and then from the fiscal side, looking at some of these small business loans, I know that it sounds like the financial sector, the private sector is actually stepping up and doing some deferment on mortgages for commercial business. Assuming that can all come into play, I think that can help mitigate the risk, but the risk, it's certainly there.
Yeah. So, finally, without asking you to give, you know, particular advice or asking you to speculate without all the details, do you say to some of these businesses, you know, on the knife's edge, do you say, look, guys, just hold on as long as you can?
Yeah, no, that's definitely, I know that's, you know, it's hard for me to say that, you know, not being in that position specifically, but hold on. Look for ways to innovate. So are there ways to continue operations at some level? Work with your lenders, you know, engage with the public sector in terms of some of the resources that the public sector is offering. You know, just that what's hard about this is you've got the public health thing layered on top of it.
Yeah.
But really look for ways that you can, you know, follow best practices on the health side and hang on.
Juliette Tennert, she's the Director of Economic and Public Policy Research at the Kim C. Gardner Policy Institute at the University of Utah. Juliette, thanks very much for joining us.
Doug, thank you so much.
Joining us now on the program is Ryan Lauder. He's a chef and the owner of several Salt Lake City restaurants, the Copper Onion, Copper Common, Copper Kitchen, among others. He's joining us by phone. Ryan Lauder, welcome to you.
Hey, Doug. Thanks for having me on. Love the show.
Thanks. How's it going? Like, that's my first question. How's it going?
It's going. I mean, we're still operating. We're limping along, but Kitchen and Common are doing curbside. And I don't know. It's like watching a storm come in, and all the forecasters are on holiday. You know,
yeah.
You just don't know what's coming next. So, where we are.
Yeah. What was it like, because I know you had to have this conversation with some, what was it like to talk to some of your employees and tell them that they had lost their job?
Well, we rounded up the bulk of our employees. We have about 150 people, and you know, they're people you like and care for, and you don't want to see go. And what we did is we just tried to, you know, reassure them. We pay the bulk of all of our employees' health insurance, so from dishwashers to managers, that we'll be carrying that through April at least. We told them all to get on unemployment Saturday, because you'll have a check by the 31st. And then we've just been reaching out to employees, you know, for emotional support. And, you know, look, Doug, I was a chef in New York City in 2008 running a restaurant. I lost my job in 2009. And at the end of the day, unemployment is doable. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're still getting a check. It seems like this big, scary monster, but, you know, it happens. You check in on Sundays and you get a check. So it is doable. You might lose a little weight and can't do everything you want, but it works.
Yeah. Do you, we were talking to Juliet Tennard about like gift certificates and people who are reaching out to do what they can. Does that help? I mean, is curbside service, for example, it's not everything, but it's an adaptation. And does it work? Does it help as far as you can tell?
It does help. Now, our finances for the restaurant, I, you know, 2008 kind of burned fear into my soul to keep cash reserves and, you know, be ready for anything. So we've always been prepared to have a closure, you know, a recession, being able to, you know, carry health insurance and this and that. The curbside works. We're not taking a thing. This is solely for those managers and some employees who want to work. So we're like, hey, look, guys, this is a free box where we can make some money, but they can make some money, cover their wages, basically. Mm-hmm. So the gift certificates do help, but, you know, one thing I've encouraged guests is if you don't want to come in, if your, you know, health is vulnerable, if you live with somebody vulnerable, then don't. You know what I mean?
Yep.
We don't want to put guilt on anyone to come support our business. You know, we'll be fine. We'll weather this thing one way or another. But, you know, I think it's most important that everyone takes care of themselves and their loved ones. And, you know, as I talk to friends of mine in Milan, Italy, it's like war over there. I mean, it's bad. And, you know, when you start hearing about, you know, somebody's older comes into the hospital and then, you know, a mother with a couple of kids and there's one ventilator. Guess who's getting that ventilator?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's terrible. And just that's what, you know, it's like something, it could get to that point. So we're not encouraging people to come in or buy gift certificates if they need that money. You know, if you live with vulnerable people or yourself, if you have health risks, then, you know, take care of yourself. But we are there. We're taking every measure doing curbside, you know, taking temperatures. And I mean, we're operating like a hospital in there to make sure our own employees stay safe and healthy and that we can also, you know, feed people who need it.
You sound remarkably calm.
Yeah, maybe that was from a few days of stress and laying off people, and I don't know. We've tried to put together such a plan and rationing out toilet paper to employees to stocking up. Some of our purveyors have been rationing goods and not taking on new customers, which has been really nice for us. So we've been kind of building up our supplies of rice and beans and potatoes and things like this and, you know, offering them to employees if they need them. So, I mean, honestly, I am pretty calm. I feel like there are things that need to be done. And, the best way to move forward is to have focus and stay calm.
Yeah. Well, and I'll say this to you, but I extend that to all the other businesses dealing with all of this. Good luck to you.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
It's Ryan Lauder. He's a chef and owner of several Salt Lake City restaurants. He joined us. Today in the program, we've been talking about the impacts of the coronavirus on local communities, businesses, arts organizations, neighbors, friends. How are you all coping? We asked some of you to share some of your thoughts. Garen Savage wrote this: I work for Weber State. The last few weeks have been crazy as we've tried to make the switch to online. Very grateful, though, for my family that it's not directly at risk from this, but we're doing our part not to risk spreading it to those who are. Cadence Woodland writes, she's an American expat in London, says it's been a bit surreal, to be honest. We have to monitor the news in multiple countries to see how it's affecting us personally, and our employers are trying to adapt to shifting government guidance that can change dramatically from day to day. Joining us now on the program is Jerry Rapier. He's the artistic director at Plan B Theater Company in Salt Lake City. Jerry, welcome to you.
Thank you.
How are you?
Well, it's almost too difficult to wrap our minds around it at Plan B, and also with my colleagues around the city and state, just because it happens so quickly, and it keeps happening quicker and quicker as the days progress. How to not only manage existing programming, but how to plan for the immediate future.
Yeah. Say something about a lot of the people who work in performing arts, because you've talked about the fact that in some ways they're also doing other jobs. You know, they have a side gig, and so you're hit from both sides, basically.
Yeah, with very few exceptions, those in our field, in the performing arts, broadly speaking, it's a gig sector. People go from one contracted gig to one contracted gig. It is not full-time benefited employment all the time. And generally, those working in such a way are supplementing that income with other gigs. So the people who are creating, usually creating the work and the art and the things that give other people escape at times like this, are also the people who are not able to work and not able and are hit from both sides.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a stereotype for a reason that an actor is a server, because that's the
right.
The way you can piece together a life. And so if you're working in both of those sectors, and the entire field of the performing arts has sort of disappeared overnight, and you know, there's no seated service for 30 days in restaurants in Utah. What do you do?
Yeah. How close to the margins are not just you, but the arts organizations that you're talking to? How drastic could it be if this lasts a long time?
It's drastic immediately.
Yeah.
I just spoke with my colleague, Laura Hurtado at UMOCA. And instantly, they had to lay off two staff members and reduce their contract workers from 6 to 2. It's instant. We're a whole field that is dependent on drawing people together for a communal experience. And when you can't draw people together, you can't create the work. You can't share the work. You can't you can't raise the money to continue the creation of the work. And so it's very, very complicated, mainly, I think, because, of course, we're all a little unsure, and people like myself are also trying to figure out how to homeschool at the same time, which is its own thing. But there have been times when we, as a sector, have been at risk in certain ways, but I've never in my 20 plus years running an arts organization ever looked around and seen that everyone is equally at risk in real time.
Yeah.
And not just everyone in the city or the county or the state, but in the country and around the world. But what comes with that is this unbelievable sense of community and camaraderie, and the fact that I know, even if I'm not communicating daily with my colleagues at other companies, we all know that we're in it together, and that we're going to share what we figure out, Of course, right now, everyone is scrambling to figure out how to digitize and put their work online. For those of us, there are 15 arts organizations that are POPS organizations, which stands for the Professional Outreach Program in the schools. And I don't think this has been a huge part of the conversation as of yet, but we collectively serve every school in every school district in Utah. And how do we do that now when not only can we not reach the schools, but now that everyone's at home, how do we still serve the kids? We've got to individualize things a little bit. We've got to figure out how to get the information to the school, from the school to the parents, and make sure that everyone can stream, can even access the internet. And I've been really heartened to see how school districts around the state are really trying to help with computers placed in homes for families that don't have them. And Comcast has been making service available for $9.95 a month to families that don't have it. The upside to all of this is the amazing mobilization of community in a different way. And I think what we're learning, separate from the fiscal trauma, which it is trauma, is we're learning really quickly how to look at our own work a little bit differently, and how to serve our patrons and our supporters in a new way. And even though it's terrifying and overwhelming, it is also invigorating and rewarding.
Jerry Rapier, he is Artistic Director of Plan B Theater Company. Jerry, thanks very much, and good luck to you. Thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you.
Let me come back to Matthew LaPlante and Shireen Gourbani here finally in the few minutes we have left. I guess this question, how do you figure, you guys, this is going to leave us? I mean, it's going to take months. It seems almost certain more than a year to work through all of this. Have you had time to think about how this is going to leave us finally? Not just in economic terms, but like, you know, in emotional terms and all those other kind of more abstract terms.
I think about this with my own son, who's five, and last week had some big questions about what the coronavirus is, and had a lot of, you know, personal dialogue in my house about it. He's definitely been stressed. It's clear that he's feeling the impacts of it. I just hope that it allows us to create those bigger and stronger connections and bridges and resiliency across our entire community. So person to person, neighbor to neighbor, and then across larger swaths of us.
I think this is going to leave us with a greater sense of who we are. And, you know, like just in this conversation, this short hour, I've heard these common themes. We are a community that may not have been prepared for this specific crisis, but we're well prepared. And we're a community of innovators. And we're a community that believes in being in things together. And to the extent that we come away from this with anything predictable at all, looking, you know, I don't know, 9 months, a year in the future, whatever it is, I think it's that. I think we're going to know those things about ourselves all the more.
It's so important, too, to remember that the economic health is really driven by our personal health. Huh. So the number one thing that people need to do in this time is follow the public health guidelines.
I wonder, you know, all this talk about social distancing, and I've heard it described as physical distancing. Let's physically distance, but try to keep our social solidarity. You think that's possible?
I do. I've been doing it. I've been having regular, you know, sort of conference calls with my friends in the evening, sometimes video, sharing stories of the day. We can still connect, and it's so important that we do.
We could have gone through this as a nation 30 years ago, right? There's nothing that says that this virus had to hit us at this time.
Yeah.
And 30 years ago, we were not nearly as connected in the way that we are connected now. We didn't have the tools. We couldn't have sent kids home to be taught remotely because we didn't have those tools. So we have the tools to survive this as a community, as a people, and I think we're going to.
Matthew LaPlante is a Utah-based journalist, also an associate professor of journalism at Utah State University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Doug.
And Shireen Gourbani, at-large member of the Salt Lake County Council. Really grateful to you, too. Thank you.
Happy to be with you.
Can I leave people with this? This was something my daughter sent this week. Oh, now I'm getting emotional. It's from Mr. Rogers. When I was a boy and I would see scary things in the news, my mother would say to me, "Look for the helpers. You will always find people who are helping." Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts, and we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Elia Vallarta, and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.